Hi, podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today, I'm talking out with Dr. Cody Hartley of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're talking about their Far Wide Texas exhibit, which goes on until October 30th. We are still in the process of lining up sponsors for Let's Talk Art with Brooke, but in the meantime, if you'd like to support the podcast, please look for my book, Reptiles on Caffeine, on Amazon. So you are the head curator at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe, New Mexico. What does that job involve? Are you like the boss of all curators?
I oversee the curatorial department, so that includes one curator who loves to joke that I am the boss of her, as well as our conservator and our registrar and collections management staff.
Cool.
So everything that has to do with exhibitions, caring for the collection, so forth, falls under my umbrella.
Awesome. Well, that sounds like an exciting job.
So it's very fun. I love what I do.
Yeah. So how did you get into art and Georgia O'Keeffe and all of that?
Well, I grew up in a household with an artist. My mother's a painter, and my grandparents were artists, so there was always art being made and talk about art when I was a kid.
Right.
In college, I started studying art history and found that I had a bit of an affinity for it. I loved those slide ID exams.
Right.
When most people hated them, I was enjoying myself.
Right.
I went on to pursue a PhD in art history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And I studied American art, focused on American art of the late 19th to mid 20th centuries. Worked in museums the whole time I was in school, the University Art Museum and the Santa Barbara Museum of Art, where I was in graduate school. And from there, made my way through several museums, spent some time in Massachusetts, first at the Clark and then at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, and really kind of cut my teeth in the museum world of working at those great institutions.
Right.
And then 3 years ago, moved back across the West and took the position in Santa Fe at the O'Keeffe Museum.
Cool. So when I think about Georgia O'Keeffe, she's such an icon. And, I mean, where to start? There's just so much.
There is so much. I think a lot of my colleagues, when I mentioned I was taking the job, I got a couple of slightly snide comments like, a single artist museum, won't that be boring? But she really rewards the attention. Her career is so fascinating. She's so important for the development of modernism in the 20th century, and her life is just incredible. She's a remarkable individual, so it's never dull. I love delving in deeper to her life and times.
Right. Yeah, she's, I really, really admire her and really, really like her work. So this exhibit is called, I thought it was called Texas Watercolors, but it's called Big Wide, or what's it called? Big Wide Texas?
Far Wide Texas.
Far Wide Texas, excuse me.
So
tell me about that, and what are you focusing on in this exhibition?
Sure. So this is actually a presentation of the watercolors that O'Keeffe produced between 1916 and 1918, when she was living in West Texas. So just a brief kind of overview of O'Keeffe's biography. She is born in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and moves around quite a bit. She studies art at the Art Institute of Chicago, the Art Students League in New York. So she's got pretty solid training. She's a student of William Merritt Chase and others. She's also got to make a living. Her family can't support her. She's really not interested in being married at that point in her life.
Right.
So she knows that she's got to find a career and make a living. And there aren't a lot of options for women in the 19-teens.
Right.
So teaching becomes the way she decides she'll make her livelihood. She gets a teaching certificate, does a number of teaching jobs, ends up being offered a position teaching art at West Texas Normal College, which was basically a teaching school, and is still there as West Texas State University now. And she moves to West Texas to teach art. She's living in Canyon, Texas, and loves it, absolutely loves the West.
Mm-hmm.
So this show is really looking at the work she created during that period. And the teens are a remarkable moment. It's really when O'Keeffe adopts abstraction as a primary means of working.
Uh-huh.
And if you think about what was happening in the art world internationally at that point, abstraction was pretty fresh and new.
Right.
There weren't a lot of artists who were comfortable with abstraction and really using it in the way she was. So she's pretty original and innovative in that sense.
Exactly.
In West Texas, she continues to develop that abstract practice, continues to draw while she's teaching her students. And we end up seeing these just kind of incredible visions of the landscape where she was living, of the kind of surrounding environment,
mm-hmm.
As well as a whole amazing series of nudes that are actually self-portraits.
Right.
She had no other models, so she used herself in a mirror as her model.
Uh-huh.
And they're really quite incredible. The watercolors are fluid. They feel spontaneous and full of energy.
Right.
But we also know from looking closely that they're very carefully conceived.
Mm-hmm.
We can see pencil lines underneath most of them. So she had the composition and the design completely refined and done before she touched the paper with watercolor.
Sure. Well, that makes sense. That, that would make sense. You would want to have a good base for your painting.
Well, it's kind of incredible to see how control she has. You know, watercolor can be such a difficult medium.
Right.
Depending on how saturated your paper is and how quickly the paint flows.
Mm-hmm.
And she retained that energy, but achieved exactly the effect she wanted. These are also the years that she begins her correspondence with Alfred Stieglitz.
Mm-hmm.
He does his first one-woman show of her work in 1917. So it's a kind of amazing moment for her life. She's making decisions. She's in her late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So she's making decisions about how she's going to spend her life. And for a period, she's pretty convinced that she's going to marry a man in Texas,
mm-hmm.
and keep teaching at the college. And that will be the rest of her life.
Right.
And we know now, of course, that's not what happened.
Right, right.
But at that moment in her life, she was figuring it out.
Uh-huh.
And at some point, Alfred Stieglitz basically says, I want you to come to New York. I will fund a year worth of painting, and we'll see where it goes.
Wow.
And she took her chance and went back to New York. And that's really when her public and professional career was launched,
mm-hmm.
with Alfred Stieglitz's support and promotion.
Right.
But the Texas years are really where we see her finding her own voice. And for those of us that have spent so much of our time looking at her work, it's kind of a surprise and a joy to realize that she's really fully formed,
right.
as an artist before she even leaves Texas.
Yeah. Yeah. She moved around quite a bit. So she, your gallery's in New Mexico. So, and that's where I normally think of her being.
Right.
But she really has been everywhere.
She was all over. I mean, she's so strongly associated with this place and this landscape. She moved here permanently in 1949,
mm-hmm.
and spent the rest of her life more or less living in New Mexico. I say more or less because she was constantly traveling.
Right.
But this became her permanent home. But she'd been visiting the region since 1929.
Mm-hmm.
So she spent a significant portion of her life and dedicated many of her paintings to this region. So she is really, I think, associated with this land very strongly by many of her fans and the general public.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right. If you look at her life, she was constantly on the go. She lived all over the country, mm-hmm. from the Midwest to the East Coast to the West to the South. And she took something from each of those places.
Mm-hmm.
She grew as a result of her time in each of those places. She spent time in Virginia, South Carolina, that I mentioned all the time in Texas.
Right.
And often she was moving back and forth.
Uh-huh.
So she might be in New York for a few months and then back to see her family in Virginia for a few months, and then might go see family in Chicago. And so she was always moving. And even when she moved to New Mexico, or in the 30s when she was visiting New Mexico, mm-hmm. she was never still. She was constantly exploring the region,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes on horseback, often driving, taking these long trips around the Southwest on her first summer in New Mexico. And you have to imagine, even getting here today is a little bit of a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
In the 20s, it was not easy to get to Santa Fe.
Right.
She made her way out here and then almost immediately decided to go on a driving trip with friends, exploring all the way west from Taos to the Grand Canyon, up into Arches in Utah, back to Colorado, and then down to Taos. That's a distance of about 1,500 miles.
Wow.
And that's a difficult trip today on paved highways with air conditioning.
Yeah, I know. I can't even imagine this.
And she did the exact same trip again, like two summers later. I mean, she was always exploring. She would wake up in the morning and go out and walk into the landscape immediately. So I think there's just this sense of I have of her of never being still, always paying attention, always observing what was around her.
Right. Yeah, I think that's so cool. I think that's so great. So tell me about some of these paintings that are in this exhibition.
Sure. So there are a number of landscapes, and they're often inspired by the geology, geography of canyon, the Palo Duro Canyon outside of Canyon, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very large canyon. It's actually second in the U.S. to the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not as well known. Very dramatic. Similar in a lot of ways to the country around her home at Ghost Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
So I do kind of imagine that when she found Ghost Ranch, there may have been a sense of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Very dramatic colors, lots of reds and yellows and so forth.
Right.
And she captured all that, and she began her process of kind of producing and finding the essential elements of what was in front of her,
mm-hmm.
and painting only what mattered, only what was essential to convey the experience of what she was looking at.
Mm-hmm.
There are other paintings, Crane Across the Desert at Night, for example, or there's some amazing evening star paintings where she's really paying attention to the sky. She's enjoying the twilight or early morning light and conveying that in her artwork. They're, again, really blending abstraction with a loose representation of the landscape in front of her.
Mm-hmm.
That's, of course, something that we see in her work for the rest of her career, but to see these very early works where she's doing that is kind of revelatory.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Now, this Far Wide Texas exhibition is part of the Becoming a Modern Artist series. What's that?
So, yeah, we've actually recently kind of redone all of our galleries following a series of thematic concepts. So less and less we're doing kind of big changing exhibitions,
mm-hmm.
Where we empty everything out and put something different in every time. And instead, we're going to provide a kind of constant thread of topics that illuminate O'Keeffe's career and life, her context here in New Mexico and other places.
Mm-hmm.
So these themes are things like how she used abstraction and mm-hmm. referred to the natural world, her early career, her time in New York, both New York City and Lake George,
mm-hmm.
her time in New Mexico. We also have a gallery that's focused on some of her late works when she's traveling the globe and frequently in the air and begins a new series inspired by the views she has from an airplane.
Uh-huh.
So we're looking kind of her late works and then her legacy too.
Right.
And so the idea is that these themes are stable and constant, but the content inside those themes will change as we rotate objects from our collection. So my hope is that visitors to the O'Keeffe Museum will always see something new and unexpected, but they'll also always be able to get the kind of broad overview and grounding in her life and career that most of our visitors come here seeking.
Cool. Yeah, with one reference to you mentioned her being in the airplane. You have the Above the Clouds series, which I think is really cool. She used the airplane as her studio.
She did. It's quite wonderful. So she starts traveling internationally in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
After Stieglitz's death, he passes away in 1946. She spends a few years settling his estate, and then she moves permanently to New Mexico in 1949.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 1950s, she starts traveling, and she's really, it's quite amazing. She is all over the planet on these long, long many month trips to all corners of the globe. That experience of flying really opens up new subject matter for her paintings.
Right.
She starts by painting the places she's visiting.
Mm-hmm.
So there are paintings we have up for now, for example, of places in Peru she visited, Machu Picchu and other sites.
Mm-hmm.
Mount Fuji from a trip to Japan. There's that kind of sense of painting the sights as she's traveling.
Right.
But what really happens soon after that is she becomes more fascinated by what she sees from the air than what she sees on the ground. So she paints views of the horizon from the airplane, looking out across the clouds. She also paints the view of the land from that high vantage point, rivers. And so they're highly abstract. They're hard to even recognize as rivers, really, but there's these amazing kind of branching forms of line and color. It's fun. The cloud paintings are quite enjoyable because they're very iconic for her. But the early Texas watercolors include clouds that are very similar, so it's wonderful to see that constancy of her vision and creativity
right.
between works made in her 20s and works made in her 60s and 70s.
That's really cool. I bet that's really cool.
She had an incredible consistency. While she was always innovative and always devising new and creative ways to work, there's at the same time this core language and core fascination she had with certain forms, certain shapes, kind of her visual motifs and language that she returns to again and again. I think that's partly what makes her work as a group so coherent and fascinating, is that she uses the same language to say many, many things.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's really cool. And then she traveled around in a Model T Ford, and she used that as a studio. That could not have been comfortable.
When she was spending time in New Mexico in the early 30s, her first summer here, when she arrived, she did not know how to drive.
Uh-huh.
And she realized that to see this country, a car would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So she asked Tony Lujan, who was the husband of Mabel Dodge Lujan, her host in Taos, if he would show her how to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And he did for a while until she hit a gate, and I think he was done. But she kept at it, and she bought herself a car.
Uh-huh.
And she actually had that car shipped back to New York. She would drive that car back and forth herself or with friends when she would make her trips out here.
Uh-huh.
At one point, had a vehicle modified so she could use it as a studio.
Mm-hmm.
So she could kind of open it up, take out the seats, and set her canvas there. There's a nice Ansel Adams photo of her. Ansel was a friend of Keith Stevens, of course.
Right.
A nice photo of her painting in her car. And I think it's a lovely story. I can't imagine that she did it that frequently.
Right.
Because it would have gotten so hot and so uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking.
So, you know, a couple of months out of the year, it might have worked just fine.
Right.
But in the middle of the summer.
Yeah, in the fall, might be nice.
The bugs are one thing, but.
Right. Yeah, that's just crazy. So, yeah. So Ansel Adams photographed her?
He did, yeah. So, Kate's one of the most photographed women of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Being married to Alfred Stieglitz, of course, this was part of the reason for that. One of his great ambitions was to create a complete portrait of a person.
Mm-hmm.
So, he produced more than 300 photos of O'Keeffe throughout her life.
Wow.
Trying to kind of document her in all moods, all stages.
Mm-hmm.
And so that alone is a remarkable photographic accomplishment and artistic kind of ambition. But she also had many other friends who were photographers. Not many people took her photo during Stieglitz's lifetime. That was kind of an intimidating bar.
Right.
Ansel Adams did. Mm-hmm. Adams was a protege of Stieglitz. He was closer and felt more confident.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those photos are fun because they're casual. O'Keeffe, you might think of kind of a typical O'Keeffe image, and she usually is very stern-looking.
Right.
Independent and alone in the desert, that kind of image.
Yeah.
And that was a persona that she created, really kind of for the public.
Uh-huh.
The people that knew her, that spent time with her, her friends and neighbors, her staff, remember being very witty, uh-huh. very generous, laughing frequently, smiling a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And Ansel Adams captures that. She would drop her guard for Ansel Adams and a few other photographers who were friends first and photographers second.
Right.
And so it's fun to see those photos where you get a sense of her personality coming through and her dropping the kind of persona that she used for the public.
Yeah, because all the pictures I've seen of her, she seems just very stern.
Yes, that's the image she created.
Yeah.
She was very savvy about kind of marketing and understood, before people really talked about it in these terms, she understood what it meant to be a celebrity artist.
Right.
There's this great story of Andy Warhol coming to visit O'Keeffe.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of Warhol and O'Keeffe meeting.
Yeah,
I do too. I can only imagine her kind of thinking, you think you invented celebrity artists? I've been doing this a lot longer, buddy.
Yeah, seriously.
she was a record-breaking, very popular, very acclaimed artist in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
She achieved a level of fame early on that was unheard of.
Yeah. And she seemed to do it like just by breaking all the rules, just like being very, very independent. And I don't, from what I've read of you know, women, that wasn't the norm. And
it was not the norm. She was absolutely kind of a maverick in that sense,
mm-hmm.
Both artistically and in her lifestyle and personality. As an artist, she, as I mentioned, had a very solid training, kind of a traditional fine arts training. But she also had the confidence, in part after being inspired by the work of Arthur Wesley Dow,
mm-hmm.
she had the confidence to trust herself. And she talks about this kind of moment in 1915 when she realizes that everything she had been taught, tradition, etc., was useless to her. And she wanted to say and do her own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when she starts producing those very first abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
And she remained kind of independent her entire life. She ignored what a lesser artist might assume were the right ways to do things, the rules for composition. And somehow, despite that, she always pulled it off.
Uh-huh.
So she just had this innate sense of how to do something with confidence and certainty. In her own lifestyle, she was incredibly innovative, independent, thoughtful. She lived with a great deal of intentionality. Nothing was said or done without thought. Every aspect of her homes, her lifestyle was considered and organized to facilitate her creative practice.
Right. She was very deliberate.
Very deliberate. She did not waste time on anything she felt was a distraction or unproductive.
Right.
Anything or anyone. Because she could be very dismissive
right.
to people that she thought were just not interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of funny. So.
There are plenty of great stories of folks showing up at her gate or even at her kitchen door
mm-hmm.
wanting to talk to the famous Georgia O'Keeffe and being kicked off the property. it's interesting because I think that has fed this kind of sense that, oh, she was, you know, cantankerous and mean and didn't like people. She was a misanthrope.
Right.
And that's not really true. I think for any of us, if you had people on a daily basis walking through your gate and knocking on your kitchen door expecting you to talk to them.
I would do it too. That's just crazy.
I would be really annoyed by that.
I don't think anyone would handle that well.
I knocked on my gate.
Yeah. Yeah, how is that even allowed? Why are people allowed trespassing on our property?
Well, that was kind of her point, that they just had no sense of boundaries. You know, in this day and age, she would have probably had a security detail and a tighter fence and gate. But she lived in a small village in Abiquiu. She lived among a close-knit community.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want to put those kinds of barriers up.
Right.
She wanted the neighborhood kids. She would invite them. Come in. Pick some apples from the orchard. Go ahead.
Uh-huh.
As long as you share them with your family and friends, I don't mind.
Oh, that's
so she didn't want to put up those barriers, but especially in the 70s, late 60s, early mid-1970s, when she really became kind of had a second wave of fame, people got pushy, and she resented it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. So that's, I mean, yeah, you want to be, you know, nice to people and, you know, around people and be social, but you don't want people to, like, trample on your, I don't know. I totally understand that.
I think it's pretty, it's easy to sympathize with her. And there are great stories. For every story of her turning someone away, and she famously turned away people like Gloria Steinem.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
Judy Chicago. and that had more to do with her dismissal of feminism.
Uh-huh.
But for every one of those stories, there's also a story about a young artist who showed up one day and spent the entire day in conversation with O'Keefe, and she was wonderful and supportive and engaging. And so those stories you don't hear as often.
Right.
That happened too.
Right. Yeah, I read that the feminists tried to embrace her, like were like loving her because of her paintings and stuff, and she really wanted nothing to do with them. And I just think that's great.
Well, it's a funny kind of historic moment because, you know, the feminist art movement is really looking to carve out a space for women artists.
Uh-huh.
And O'Keefe represents this amazing model.
Right.
She'd done everything her way. She'd achieved enormous fame.
Mm-hmm.
She had kind of beaten the men at their own game.
Right.
And so for every reason imaginable, she was easily made a poster child for feminist art.
Right.
But from her perspective as an individual, she didn't really, even though she had lived a kind of incredible feminist life,
mm-hmm.
she came of age in a different era and didn't really share the political aspirations of the feminist movement.
Right.
And didn't want to be limited as a feminist artist.
Right.
In effect, I'm paraphrasing here, but she made a comment at one point that I didn't like it when the men tried to put me in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like it when the women tried to put me in a box.
That's great.
You know, she said that, you know, the men put her down as a great woman painter.
Mm-hmm.
And her response was, I'm a great painter.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah, exactly.
My gender has nothing to do with it.
Right.
And so, you know, decades later, when the feminists try to use for different purposes, but use a similar rhetoric,
right.
She uses it just as strongly.
Right. Oh, I think that's so great.
She was always her own person. I mean, she was not, she would not be anything else.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. So what other kind of stuff do you have going on there? What kind of stuff do you want to promote?
Well, I think it's going to be a very busy summer for O'Keefe. In our galleries, we've got projects I described on view. But at the same time, there's a major retrospective of her work opening in London at the Tate Modern.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a large show. I would hazard to say that it's the most significant international exhibition ever for Georgia O'Keeffe,
mm-hmm.
and possibly one of the most significant exhibitions, period, for her. It'll bring her enormous visibility. It travels from London to Vienna and then on to Toronto, which will be the only North American stop. So it's incredible for us as the O'Keeffe Museum. We're committed to ensuring that her legacy is secured long into the future. And for an institution as respected as the Tate Modern to give over their galleries and make her their featured artist for the summer, is an enormously important moment.
Right.
I think a lot about what will O'Keefe's reputation be in 20 years, in 50 years, in 100 years, and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
For so many of our visitors coming to our galleries every day, fewer and fewer of them have a living memory of Georgia O'Keefe.
Right.
For them, she has always been a dead artist.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So how do I make her work vibrant and meaningful to them? And the Tate Modern really helps establish her as a great artist of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Not a great artist of the pre-war American 20th century, but a great artist of the 20th century. And that, I think, is very important in securing the long-term stability of her reputation.
Yeah.
So that's very exciting. To see that happening. So this is a great time if folks are in London.
Yeah.
It's a great time to see a kind of once-in-a-lifetime gathering of O'Keefe artwork.
Yeah, definitely.
An amazing venue. back in Santa Fe will, of course, kind of balance for us is to be able to show these watercolors that are so rarely seen. Mm-hmm. Most of them were kept by O'Keeffe for her lifetime. They were almost never exhibited. They're in pristine condition, just vibrant colors. Mm-hmm. We've borrowed from a number of institutions, so we have as many on view as is conceivably possible. Mm-hmm. And we've produced a beautiful catalog that illustrates all of the watercolors in one place. Because they're so fragile and light-sensitive, we can't share them very often. So the publication is nice in that it will be available to fans and scholars to study these works. They're all reproduced at full scale in the catalog. Uh-huh. So it's kind of like going through the original watercolors in person. It's an amazing publication.
Cool.
So I think that's a thing for people to look at for if they're here. And if someone's coming to New Mexico, they really have to do kind of have a full experience and see the landscapes where O'Keeffe painted.
Right.
So the home and studio that she maintained in Abiquiu is open for tours by appointment. That's managed by the museum. And it's really an incredible experience and gives you great insight into her daily life, her as a person, and that kind of thoughtfulness and intentionality that she brought to her living. And then the Ghost Ranch landscape. The house is not open to the public at Ghost Ranch yet. We hope to open it in future years. Mm-hmm. But the landscape is there, and it's really worth seeing. The good folks at the Ghost Ranch Retreat Center offer landscape tours, focusing on sites where O'Keeffe painted, and that's well worth doing.
Cool. Well, that sounds awesome. That sounds really great. Thank you so much, Cody, for talking with me, and I really appreciate you telling all you know about, well, not all you know, because I'm sure you know a lot more about Georgia O'Keeffe. But thank you so much for talking about this exhibition.
And thank you. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much to Dr. Cody Hartley of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum for telling us about the Texas Far and Wide exhibit. And thank you to you for listening. I know I learned a lot. If you're in the Santa Fe area, check out the gallery. If you're interested in having us promote your product or service, if you have a comment, if you have ideas for future podcasts, or would like to be on the show yourself, please contact me at arttalkwithbrooke@gmail.com. That's all one word and Brooke with an E. Thanks for listening.
Let's Talk Art with Brooke is a Hotspur Enterprises media production.